We're going to do two things this morning. We're going to do chapter 10, talk through just a brief series of the nations, where they came from, and then we're going to review for the final. And I know Eric is panicking at the final, but you need to take the final. Good. You just
over here.
Give me a razor.
Where's the razor?
No, you need the final. Because that's your final opportunity to just test what you know. You don't want to just go through life just believing that, you know, I'm doing fine. You need to test, even if you get, I don't care if you fail or not. That's not the point, but you need to try. And finish the course is the thing. Finish the course. Genesis chapter 10. Let's see, who else? I got some tests back. John, I haven't graded yours for some reason. Did I give everybody else their tests? Okay. Those exams would help you in preparation for the final. Genesis chapter 10. We're going to look at Noah's family. And Proverbs 22, verse 1. Graham, would you read that for us, please?
A good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold.
Okay, good name. There are lots of names in the world. A lot of crazy names. You're going to find a list of names every time you turn around in your Bible. There's always the name of somebody. Names mean something, and they usually take on the character of the person. You know, if somebody was named something. They can either take on the characteristic of their name, or they can redefine the meaning of their name. I find that Christians redefine the meaning of their name. I want Craig to mean something good. I want, you know, as a pastor, I want everybody who thinks of Eddie and they think of that name, Ediberto, they think that it's a good name. Now, when you come through the Bible, there are a lot of names. And these names are of people that become nations, and what kind of a nation it takes on the characteristics usually of its founder. We're called a holy nation, aren't we? According to First Peter chapter 2, verse 9, we are peculiar people, but we take on the characteristics of our founder, Jesus Christ. So this may seem like a boring chapter with nothing but names, but the treasures here are for the student of the word are almost immeasurable. Here you're going to find the following truths. You're going to see a unbroken line of people back to Adam. Now, the popes want to have a list of unbroken lines back to Peter, and it is broken. They've lost. They have no records that can prove that their popes all run back to Peter. It's a joke. They invent about 15 of those names. But we have an unbroken line of people back to Adam. So to trace God's hand in history all the way forward until the Messiah. That's where Luke traces the genealogy from Jesus through Mary back to Adam in Luke chapter 3. Now, a connection that makes Abram make historical sense with the rest of the world's history. This is bringing you to chapter 11. And into chapter 11, you run into this man named Abram. And everything's connected. You're running from Noah, and you're almost in a race to get to Abram. There are entire empires and world people groups being discussed and just passed right over like they don't exist, because God's trying to get the reader to Abram. All of world history begins in 2200 B.C. How can we say that, John? Why would we say that all world history begins in 2200 B.C.?
Because the flood washed away everything else.
That's it. So whatever history there was before is gone. Okay. So our history doesn't even go back to 4004 B.C. The first dynasty in China begins at, I'll give you one guess, 2200 B.C. I was actually looking at Wikipedia, and there it was. They could not go beyond 2200 B.C. That's as far back as they can go. And, no, we can't. We don't have any written records. We don't have any dynasties, we don't have any empires, we don't have any people groups before 2200 BC. As a matter of fact, these people, these great archaeologists and great historians say, it's kind of funny, just civilization just exploded on world history. It's like it just came out of nowhere, even though they know that in their minds it's been there for millions and millions of years.
So, can I ask a question? I thought the flood was 4,400 BC.
No, sir. Creation was 4,004 BC.
All right, okay.
That's why I asked the question. I'm trying to get you to think. Why did I say 2,250? Why do we say 4,000? Okay, we're getting world history restarts. See, if I were to be really precise, but I wanted to trick you. The first dynasty in China is 2200 BC. Greece, Babylon, India, Egypt all begin around 2200 BC. Kind of a unique chance that all of that would happen at the same time. How could that happen like that? This chapter shows where the three races came from and how they spread out. It also shows the ancestors of each of the people groups. I've got a huge history book. It's a reprint of a book from, about 1890 or 1900. You unfold it, and it is a line of history of all the nations and how they spread out and stuff like this. It's what every student was taught back at the turn of the 20th century. And obviously we've moved on, which much more advanced. We don't believe any of that. We believe that we should be promoting civil rights, and we should be learning about same-sex marriage, and we should be promoting our environmental issues, our climate. I was trying to think of climate, stuff like that, instead of learning real history. I mean, history is boring. What is important is to learn that we've got to protect our economy and we've got to protect our environment. So, yes, sir.
Somewhere around where they are, stop, they get off, they are, him and his sons, and then the three sons go their own way. But didn't all start exactly 2200?
Within 100 years.
I mean, from the they are down to China takes an awful long walk, or row in a boat, and then down into Egypt and so on. I mean, it couldn't all start.
Okay. When okay, all right. You've learned a form of thinking. It's called didactic. What you're thinking is you have to be absolutely precise in order for you to be true and for it to be right. I come from an old school. I've read too many books to know that nobody can be absolutely precise and yet can be true. And when I say 2200, I'm being general. I'm being general. Everybody's in their place within 100 years after the flood. Okay. So it takes 100 years, especially if you're being chased by bears, lions, and tigers. When people are spreading out, they're spreading out sometimes hurriedly. There are natural disasters going on. They move to an area, then they see volcanoes going off, and so they move to another area. They're rapidly multiplying. There are all kinds of different conditions that are driving them. And even though when we see China, if I had a world map over here, when we see China, we think that means that they're way on the farthest reaches of China. The China Empire may have, and I'm not a historian, an archaeological historian when it comes to China and stuff like that, but they may have started on the western side of China before they spread out. When I say the beginning of the dynasty, I don't mean that they sat down and they had 4 million people in order to rule. They may have only had 400 or 4,000 when they started their empire. So I don't want you to learn the didactic, precise, because that's how people learn in university. They go to university and the teacher is constantly attacked and disregarded or challenged because he's not absolutely precise. But that's the breeding ground of universities. They challenge everybody so that nobody believes anything. Instead of, you know what, generally that is true. To find it precise, we're going to have to do our own research. And people people come to church, people come to Bible Institute, and they want precise answers instead of, yeah, I got the truth. I got the generalization. If I want to know the precise time when something happens, it may take a lot of effort to find out. So 2200 is just a general. The point is, the oldest tree in the world is about, I'll give you one guess how old it is. 4,600 years old. How do they know? They drilled into it, and they counted all the rings. Literally. They actually have records. There's a tree in Palestine, over there near the Mount of Olives. And they did a very precise surgical thing, and they found out it was so many years old. Then they went through record books, and that tree has been recorded as being on the edge of this cliff for the last 1,700 years. People would say, I took a walk near, and there was this tree overhanging. And hundreds of people have described this one tree. The point is, here's this tree that was there at the time of Jesus Christ. The people were walking by it near the Mount of Olives. Okay, and that's cool. That just made me think of these two trees. Forgive me, the second tree of the Mount of Olives has nothing to do with this first tree that I'm talking about. But the oldest tree, they've done all kinds of carbon, radiocarbon testing on it, and they did ring counting, all the layers of rings, and it comes out to be about 4,600 years old. No other tree is older than that. Isn't that funny? Wouldn't you expect that if this planet has been here for 4.5 billion years, that you'd find trees that are 700,000 years old? Wouldn't you think that? But no. Only 4,600. Okay, so you'll hear Kent Ovine getting up there, and he'll say, about 5,000 years ago. About 500,000. And it's because there's this generalization that points to a bit of evidence that we're on the right track, okay? So, let's see, number four, it also shows that ancestors of each of the people groups, countries, nations, God doesn't choose to bless the conqueror, but he always blesses the one who has integrity, one who has a good name like Shem did. You're going to see God bless Shem, even though Japheth is a conqueror and he seems to take all the world's possessions. But Jesus said, a man's life does not consist of the things which he possesseth. It's about the God he possesses. So here we're going to look at the post-world, the post-flood world. Chapter 10, verse 1. Now these are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And unto them were sons born after the flood. Note that he starts off with Shem. Why would he start off with Shem when Shem's probably not the oldest?
He's the special one.
He's the one that's actually walking with God. Okay? I'd like to be the first one that God would think of. And if you want to be the first one that God thinks of, make sure you walk with God. Here, we've got eight people beginning to spread out and conquer the earth. It turns into a dog-eat-dog world again with men conquering other men. But the three sons will spread into three different directions. Shem, his name means name. That sounds funny, but it means like the name. When you say Shem, this word in Hebrew just simply means, if somebody has a name, like we just read, a good name is rather to be had. It's like saying, you're like Shem, who had a name, okay? So I'm not sure if we could say the name, but it puts the emphasis on the fact that he had a name that was memorable. So that's what Shem means. It says, this guy's got a name. He and his family head east. Remember, if I draw you a map, are you listening? For your final, okay? And you've got here in Turkey, you've got the Ark. Shem heads northeast. He ends up in the Philippines, that's right. All right? Then Ham, his name means hot. Kind of funny how the 1970s and 1980s came along and says, ooh, she's hot, ooh, he's hot. Well, that's what Ham means, as in burnt. He and his family head which direction? They head south into Africa.
Did he get burnt before or after the death?
You think black means burnt. That is, now you're into a study called genetics, and Ken Ham has some great things on One Race, a book called One Race, One Blood, and genetics through gene pooling. You bring out certain characteristics in a gene sequence that brings out the melanoma in your skin, different colorization. So, was he burnt before or after? I think he was burnt, when you say after, I think he became black. I think over time their nation became darker. I think all people that got off that ark were olive.
I don't know, brown.
That was the original color. They weren't white. Okay? I'll give you one guess which way Japheth goes. Japheth, by evidence, goes northeast. I'm sorry, northwest. So you got Japheth up here. Over time, they become white. They become white. They didn't start off white. Shem, he's that's yellow brown. And you got Ham, and he ends up black. Now every racist loves this color. Every civil rights leader hates this color. Actually, they hate that color, but they hate the fact that they feel inferior. But Shem and their connection with Israel, this is their color, and nobody seems to give them any kind of credence at all. But this is the group to follow. If you want to be a supremacist, a racist, you want to be a superior race, follow Shem. That's what the Bible says. You had your hand up, Alberto. Sorry.
No, that's not. I just wonder why Ham, become black. You know,
why he became black? There's all kinds of reasons, okay, that I can talk about, but I cannot be emphatic about because I challenge myself on some of these things. But with Ham, he has a curse on his family. Okay, now we all have a curse on us. We all have a curse from Adam. But there's a curse on him. When you follow Ham, you have a hatred of God. There's a problem with Ham. He has a curse and a judgment on that line. But I'm not heavy to say that there's nothing. Man, these guys are cursed. Everyone, the one that seems to be blessed is Shem, and they have a blessed not with physical blessings. These are physical, material. Let's do this: material blessings, physical blessings, spiritual blessings. So you want a strong human, you get a Hamite. That's why the Muslims came along and says, "No, this will work for you. This guy will work for you," because physically they were superior. Materially, they're superior. Spiritually, they're superior. It's just funny how this thing works. Now, that's as far as I go. See, a white supremacist will come on and he'll try to find all kinds of nuances and stuff and show that Japheth is blessed of God. Japheth is not blessed of God. All right? The only way Japheth ever gets, when I say Japheth, you understand what I'm talking about? White Anglo-Saxon Protestants. Europeans. The only reason why Japheth and his descendants are blessed is because they follow the God of Shem. They get saved. You follow the Germans in the Germanic peoples, the Goths, the Visigoths. They ate each other. I mean, seriously. They burnt the Druids. The Druids are up here, man. So don't think that they're superior. So,
can I just ask, Shem are the spiritual ones that are superior?
In God's eyes. In God's eyes. Okay.
Because it's just that they, like, Shem, all the direction, millions of gods.
Say again?
They have millions of gods.
Agreed. Nobody's, we're not talking about they are right, but they are more spiritual.
Okay.
At least they have gods.
Europe is an atheist.
That's right. Okay. We're speaking in generalities, but I want you to understand they are spiritual, and we're talking about the entire group of them. Of that group, if I could draw a big happy family, not happy, But out of them, there's a small group which we call Israel.
Yeah.
Okay?
That makes sense.
And it is from that group that Israel is in. Okay? And it's just amazing that that whole group is very spiritual. They're all kinds of different spirits, but that's it. These guys are materialistic, so you need to write these things down. These guys are spiritual. And these guys are physical. Now, there's a lot of emphasis. When you look at Ham and their emphasis, you've got a lot of problems with sex here. You have a lot of problems with things and the love of things here. And you have a lot of problems with religion and gods and spirituality there. But that's their dominant emphasis of each group. That doesn't mean that you meet a black man and you go, oh, you're cursed. Not at all. But as a group, they've got some problems. As a group, we have some problems. As a group, they have some problems. And the only way that God says to get right is to not to follow this group, that group, or that group, but to follow them. Okay? You see how that works? See, people, when you start making some of these conclusions, if you don't stand back and allow the bigger picture to guide you, you'll all of a sudden say, well, I mean, can you imagine some white honky claiming to be Israel? You know, all of God's blessings now are on the English. That's what they used to believe back at in the mid-1800s. The Israelism. Did you ever hear of British Israelism?
They believe they're the lost tribe of Israel.
That's right. They believe they're superior.
But it still happens.
Of course it is.
Not, I'm saying, generally there are people in the English race.
They still think they're arrogant.
Even in Northern Ireland, there are people who push that.
That's right. All right, I think this is intensely interesting. As a matter of fact, this is the foundation for the rest of your Bible. If you don't get this, you're not going to understand that in the New Testament, there are three categories of people now. Does anybody want to hazard a guess of the three categories of people now?
Jews and Christians.
Bingo. Give none offense to the Jews, the Gentiles, and you say Christians, but God said, or but Paul says, we're to the Church of God, all right, which is Christians. So that's just funny how God says three. Three, three, three. Are there problems in the church? Yes. Are there problems in the Gentiles? Jews? Yes. But they're three different groups. All right? As a matter of fact, that helps you understand that God's not all finished with the Jews. He's going to bring the emphasis back on these Jews. And I'm trying to make a target here. And he's going to focus back on Israel. He hasn't done away with them. Okay? So, keep these things in mind because they'll help you understand some of the things later on in the Bible. So we looked at the Japheth. His name means enlargement. Enlargement. And he goes northwest into Europe. So verses 2 to 5. Eric, if you'll read that, please. These are all good names. A lot of people have a problem with your names, but don't be hesitant. You're a student of the Bible. Read every name, stumble through it, and don't be discouraged by the fact that some of these names are hard to pronounce.
If you were to put the names of their names down on a list for them, there must be something to tell from.
Well, you know, one of the greatest books in heaven is the book of life that has names in it. So let's learn some names.
The sons of Japheth, Gomer, and Magor, and Madai, and Javan, and Tubal, and Meshach, and Tiras, and the sons of Gomer, Ashkenaz, Riphath, Togarmah, and the sons of Java, Elisha, and Tarshish, Dittim, and Dodan, Nim. By these were the isles of the Gentiles divided in their lands, every one after his tongue, after their families, in their nations.
All right, circle the word isles. So Japheth, how far is he going, Eric? According to that, when I had you circle that word, how far is he headed?
Into all the islands that's available to
him. That is so cool. He's not just conquering and expanding into the easy-to-go continents. He loves islands. That includes England, Ireland. He's an explorer. These are the guys that head off to the Isles of the Gentiles, all right? Look at some of their people. Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, Tiras, and the sons of Gore. That's all Northwest Europe. Ashkenaz actually ends up to be France. He heads down in an area called France. You say, how do you know that? Well, it's not quite in your Bible, but it is in history. Ashkenaz is traced to France. Rifna are the British Isles. The British Isles, they are kind of brittle. The British Isles. Togarma.
Question, though.
Yep.
Have you heard of the Ashkenazi Jews?
No, sir.
The Jews that came from Eastern Europe.
Well, how do you see? There's some history there. There's so much to try to meld into your brain. So Ashkenaz is France. Rifna ends up to be the British Isles. Togarmah is Germany and the Swedes. And the sons of Javan go. Those are the northeast coast of the Mediterranean. That's Elisha. That's Greece. Tarshish is southern Asia Minor. Tarshish. Remember Tarshish somewhere in the Bible. So who headed to Tarshish?
Paul.
He's from Tarshish.
Jonah.
Kittim is Macedonia. Dodaman is west, the western area of Asia Minor. Several of Japheth's sons are skipped over. Magog, which is Russia in Siberia. Madai, that's the Medes. Now notice the way terms. Do you see the word Madai? And it becomes Medes. That's called the evolution of language. It was pronounced, first off, as Madai, Madai. Every time you see the letters AI at the end, it usually means, you say AI. There was a little city in Canaan that Joshua tried to fight against. It was called AI. So Madai, that's the Medes. Tubal is Spain. Meshech, Italy. Tyrus, Thrace, which is north of Greece. And now, your Bible says, by these were the isles of the Gentiles divided into their lands, everyone after his tongue, after the families and the nations. This is how it was all spreading out. And notice, I'll come back to it in a minute. From a mixture of all these come the Americans. As these guys spread out, they're ultimately going to hit on the other side of the planet. They're going to arrive into America. And America's a huge melting pot. It's just one big group. Ireland would have been populated by Japheth through Gomer and then Riphath. Now the sons of Ham, verse 6 to 20, there, Barry.
And the sons of Ham, Cush and Mizraim and Phut and Canaan. And the sons of Cush, Seba and Havilah and Sabta and Reama and Sabtika and the sons of Reama, Sheba and Medan. And Cush begat Nimrod, he began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. And the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and Erech, and Akkad, and Calne, in the land of Shinar. Out of that land went forth Asher, and builded Nineveh, and the city of Rehoboth, and Calah, and reasoned between Nineveh and Calah, the same as a great city. And Mizraim begat Ludum, and Anam, and Lehabim, and Naphtuhim, and Patrusim, and Casluhim, out of whom came Philistim, and Kaphtorim, and Canaan begat Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusite, and the Amorite, and the Girgashite, and the Hivite, and the Arphite, and the Sinite, and the Arvidite, and the Zimrite, and the Hamathite. And afterward were the families of the Canaanites spread abroad. And the border of the Canaanites was from Sidon, as thou comest to Gera, and to Geza, as thou goest unto Sodom, and Gomorrah, and Adma, and Zeboim, even unto Lasha. These are the sons of Ham after their families, after their homes, in their countries, and in their nations.
All right, you've got now the family of Ham, Cush, Mizraim, Phut, Canaan. These all go south into Africa and Arabia. So you got Seba, which are the Arabians, Havilah, Sabta is Ethiopia, Rama is Sheba, and Dedan. Have these people groups. They're all, if you want to look them up on Wikipedia, they're all there. It is amazing. I still get stunned. Wikipedia is an amazing accomplishment. Whoever started Wikipedia probably thought it's going to be, you know, messed with, and people are going to put all kinds of junk on there, and there probably is a lot of junk. But I find amazing stuff that people have done intense amount of research. Not all of it is precise, but it's an amazing thing. You can type in, if you typed in Sabta, it would give you biblical references and show you history behind these things that you think, how can there be any information about these countries? But they're there.
Well, we thought the Arabians came from Ishmael.
No. The founding of the people of Arabia, Ishmael went into Arabia. There already were people there. He took over. He became very dominant. He was a wild man, okay? So he's the main group of Arabians is Ishmael, okay? There already were people there. They're nomads. But he made an empire out of them. Hmm?
So he took over Amalek, is it?
He is. Who? Ishmael?
Yeah.
Ishmael came, his mom came from Egypt. He came from Ham. Now he's born, he's half breed, he's half Jew and half Egyptian, but he goes and he brings that culture into Arabia.
He's half Abraham.
That's right, yeah, Abraham.
So Muhammad, so he descended from, so is he a Hamite, or is he?
He claims to be, and every Muslim claims to be a descendant of Abraham. End of story. Okay. So, I'm not sure how far you want to take that.
They'd be black if they were Hamites, though, wouldn't they? They'd all be black if they were Hamites.
Okay. They start off as olive brown. Okay. You mix yellow brown with blacks, and you get darker brown. That's what you get. So, but it depends on what area. Again, it's genetics. They can. There's a lot of intermixing going on, especially when they conquer nations. It's really sad when you read real history. Every conquering army goes into a town and rapes all the women and produces a new breed of children. And it just grieves when you think about what armies do. The only army that doesn't normally do that were the white Anglo-Saxon Protestant American and English troops that would go into a town and wouldn't touch the women after they conquered the town and then would go home to their wives. It's just an American amazing thing, because every other conquering empire always defiled and ruined the culture. Only Americans and English would go into a country, decimate it, and then rebuild it and pay for it out of their own pocket. So I'm not sure if that helped you or not.
A lot of the Saxons, they weren't allowed to touch the women of the countries because they viewed them as below them and they didn't want to ruin the Saxon bloodline.
I found that that may be true. I found that a lot of people, let's go to slave owners, let's go to people who had a superior view of themselves over blacks, over Asians, over everybody, but they still took advantage of them. And when they had bastard children, they would just send them away. There still was this view of, you know, since they're inferior, it's just like pedophilia. It's just, this thing is not something new. Maybe when you say Saxon's German. I don't know if that's true. Germans were vicious, so I'm not sure. When you mean Saxon, do you mean Anglo-Saxon or just Saxon?
Because
Anglo-Saxon is what you and I are. We're basically Anglo-Saxon white. But the Saxons are Germans, and Germans were ruthless. They raped and pillaged and destroyed.
It'd be more of the there was like a lot of the nations like outside of the, I suppose, at the time you'd had Germanics. They would have been pretty pagan.
Mm-hmm.
They pretty much did whatever they wanted to anything. But there was, after that, there was a mindset within certain nations in Europe that it's like, oh, we're better than everyone else. And not that they didn't do it, because everyone makes up their own minds. But I think from the high up there was,
I don't
there
disagree.
Was orders that you didn't do
well,
that.
Well, and I kind of think that's great. Now we're coming down to a name that's very important. F. Write down the word Nimrod. Nimrod is a seriously bad dude. If you want to learn about Nimrod, you need to get a book called Hislop's Two
Babylon.
John, did you ever get a chance to take a look at that?
Brother Dennis gave me a copy. I have it on my Kindle.
Oh yeah, it's really it's non easy reading. But it is intense. Now, you'll find on the internet everybody finding, oh, there's fault with this. Oh, he's not true there. If 50% of that is true, we're doomed as far as a culture, because everything that's in our culture, everything's in the Catholic Church came from this book, came as exposed by this book. Now, I believe about 80% of it is true. But it is amazing how everything ties together and goes back to one man, Nimrod. It's called Two Babylons. So it's very hard to get. It's very hard to get. But it is an invaluable resource. What'd you say, Barry? Oh, yeah. A guy named Alexander Hislop. I couldn't remember his first name. Hislop.
You mentioned it already. I downloaded it after you mentioned it in some other Genesis.
Yeah.
This is in Two Babylons.
It is. You sit down, and it's like reading an encyclopedia. But he is a resource. He didn't read it so that you would just sit back and bask in the sun. You read it for a purpose, and that is because you're trying to prove that when a priest is holding up his wafer, he's doing something that the Babylonians did 3,000 years ago. This is not something that was come up with, or 4,000 years ago. This is the worship of the disk of the sun, God, okay? So, and he proves it. The Catholic Church, those long black robes, called Father, that's what everybody did in Babylon to their priests. So, Nimrod, he began, it says, look at this word, look at these words here in verse, where was it where we began there with Nimrod? Verse 8, Cush begat Nimrod, he began to be a mighty one in the earth, okay? So, who were mighty ones called before the flood?
Giants.
Now, here's a guy who probably wasn't, you know, a giant, but he attempted to do what the giants did before, which means he tried to set up a world empire. He began to be a mighty one in the earth, a leader. And he was a mighty hunter, and underline these next three words, before the Lord, as if to say in defiance to God. And he was a rebel. Write down the word rebel, because that's what his name means. When you write down the word Nimrod, it means the rebel. Or to rebel. He's a world leader. He drew people into an empire ruled by himself. He was directly disobeying God's command to spread out. He said, we're not going anywhere. We're going to stand our ground. In Acts 17, it says that God ordained that men should spread out. He's a type of the Antichrist. Nimrod is a picture, a symbol, symbolic life of the Antichrist. And God likes shepherds, not hunters. When he says a mighty hunter, when was the last time you heard somebody say, he was a mighty shepherd? It doesn't work, all right? Jesus said, come unto me, for I am meek and lowly. Jesus did not come as a hunter, did he? But here's Nimrod, a hunter. So look at the hunters versus the shepherds. You've got Ishmael, Esau, you've got the Antichrist. He is a hunter. Alexander the Great, Caesar, Hitler. But when you've got shepherds, you've got Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, David, Jesus. These are the opposites.
Amos.
You got all kinds of people. It's not that it's wrong to be a hunter, but the idea is that God exposes and reveals somebody's life to show you a purpose, saying these guys usually didn't turn out right. Versus these guys were capable of being molded and shaped by God. You know, your attitude determines whether God's able to use you or not. And if you stay meek, you can be a meek hunter. You know that? You can be a meek programmer. You can be a meek butcher. You can be a meek anything. But usually, hunters, people who end up killing, it's like a dog. You give a dog the taste of blood, and they're dangerous from that moment on. A lot of people, you put a gun in somebody's hands, and what do? They're arrogant, you know. I got to protect my rights. Nothing wrong with protecting your rights. But usually it's hard to mold and shape that character. Number two, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord's your fill-in. It's not a good title. When he says he was a mighty hunter, he became, according to Hislop, a hunter of men. He hunted down his enemies. He was a conqueror. He was a hunter of all animals. You would not want to be a German in 1941. Because if they did a test, this was what this means, high Hitler. When they went high Hitler, It was not a rally cry in a big auditorium. It was a test. You went into a room and you go, Heil Hitler! And then everybody in that room had to stop, and they all had to say at the same time, Heil Hitler. It was a test of loyalty. And if you did not show your loyalty, you were hunted down, you were eradicated, because Hitler, just like any world emperor, demanded pure, perfect loyalty. And that was their test. It was crazy. I mean, when somebody would come into a room, Heil Hitler! It was a test to see, is everybody here a Nazi? And if you weren't, you were to be terrified. So here was Nimrod. He was a hunter of men. He hunted all animals. And he was like the mighty men of the pre-world flood. Before the Lord means he was in open rebellion against God. It was not secret. He took a place above God, as if ahead. When it says before, that means, like, I let Nita go before me, correct? I let her go ahead of me. And when it says a mighty hunter before the Lord, he was a hunter ahead of God. He was more important than God. He was not bigger than God, but in his mind maybe he was. He wanted people's worship instead of allowing people to worship and follow God. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Akkadia, what we call, Calna, and the land of Shinar. He founded four cities that were controlling cities of his ever-expanding empire. All of these four cities were around Babel. Babel was the capital of that first world empire. Babel was also the source of all the world's religions against God. So here you've got Shem, and my diagram's not sufficient, I'm sorry. You've got Shem over here, and he's got a simplistic form of worship. I mean, they live in tents, all right? But this Hamite named Nimrod sets up a city. He founds Babel. He founded this town called Babel, and it becomes a city, and then he takes over all the regions around. He creates four different cities, Babel included, and from that he starts to control the world, ever expanding around him. And in that, in order to control people, you have to control the religion. It has been the case that every king, every emperor, every dictator always wanted to say over people's hearts, wanted to have a control over people's religions. That's why they made religion equal to the king. Ireland, England has a very bad history. Let's use modern connection here. Let's go to 1300. England in the 1300s. What religion did everybody have to have? Catholic. Let's go to Italy. From 600. Well, we can go back to 500 AD. What religion did everybody have to believe? Catholic. Okay. If you wanted to be something else, were you allowed? Not at all. Now, what happened in England was a conundrum. It was a boo-boo. The king switched. His name was Henry VIII. Henry VIII is one of the three most hated men in all of history because he decided, I don't want to be a Catholic anymore. Now, not that he hated the Catholic Church. He just didn't want anybody telling him he couldn't divorce Queen Anne. So he said, I'm going to start my own church. Now, here's the problem with that. All right. Now, I kind of like him, all right, because you kind of like a little bit of rebellion in guys, especially men. Men need a little bit of rebellion, okay? Put that in your hat. But Henry VIII looked at the Pope and said, I'm not sending my tithes there. You don't do things my way, so I'm not going to do things your way. Here's a problem. He said, everybody in England is now Protestant. Now, he didn't know what Protestant meant. He was still Catholic at heart. But he said, we're now not following the Pope. And anybody who, in his nation, who was still Catholic, he hunted down. So if you were a nobleman and you owned 400,000 square miles of land, you had all these people under you, you had to swear allegiance to the religion of the king. You couldn't have your own religion. So you have Henry VIII, Protestant, who was his daughter? Who came? It was Mary who took over after him.
Bloody Mary.
And she became known as Bloody Mary. Why was she known as Bloody Mary? Because now she switched back to Rome, and all of these noblemen, all of the people in her realm, had to be forced back to Catholicism, correct? She had control of religion. I'm getting somewhere with this. Then, after Mary, who was after her?
Edward.
Huh?
Edward 7 or 6. Or was that before?
That was before. Anyway, I can't remember English history. It's Mary, Queen of Scots, and back to Protestants. After that, it got really questionable, and they had to bring another Scotsman in, James I. So, but it's back and forth, and absolute bloodshed all over. We're going back to Nimrod. We're going back to, if he's going to control a world empire, he must control religion. So, evidently, he creates what we now know as Babylonian religion that is still in existence. He was purely demonic. The devil created through him the religions that are still in our world today. It's just amazing. And he killed anybody who didn't agree with his religion. What did Jesus do to people who didn't agree with him?
Let them on their way.
He let them go. He says, leave them alone. Okay? And he actually died for his enemies. He didn't kill them. All right? So, it's just mind-boggling when you learn history. Why don't people learn history anymore, John? Or why aren't people taught history anymore? It's a trick question, I know. It's kind of hard. What would you say, Graham?
Not to make mistakes.
Well, you actually...
But they want to control people. That's why they don't teach it, because they can't learn.
You're getting there. They don't want you to learn the lessons of history. Because the lessons of history all point to the fact, man, that book's right. Wow, the only one system that works is Christianity. Okay, we're not promoting a theocracy. What is a theocracy, Barry?
Our religion rules the laws of the land.
Yeah, where our religion controls everything. Now, when was a theocracy in motion?
Moses.
Okay, Moses' day, all the way through David, all the way through up until Israelites are taken away into captivity by the Assyrians and by Babylon. Ever since then, they've never had another theocracy. You have Nehemiah trying to establish it again, didn't have a king, and you had Ezra trying to establish it, but it didn't work. It didn't last for very long. From that moment on, basically, they become occupied, and they were run by the Greeks and then by the Romans. So, the point being, we're as Bible believers, we're not trying to tell everybody to fall under the control of our religion. Okay, we're trying to get people to follow the principles of the Bible, but we allow four differences that Jesus did, which is unusual. So, we're going back. I digress.
Just digressing again. Up until about, I don't know, 15 years ago, the Free Presbyterians were quite strong in the north of Ireland, but shops, parks, everything was shut down on Sunday in the north of Ireland. You couldn't do anything on Sunday.
It was the same down here. The big building opened up on the stores on Sunday. From day nine, he opened up the doors for everyone to start working on Sunday.
Yep.
But to this day, there's tradition, if you're going to pubs and clubs, there's no dancing until the churches get out. There's no dancing and no music until after 8 o'clock and just sit and drink.
Well, all those things are, in America, we call those blue laws because people are so sad by the fact that they weren't allowed to buy drink on certain days and at certain times and things like that. Now, we still have laws that require, you go into Littles and you try, don't try it, but people try and buy beer before 10:30, they're not allowed. Oh,
really?
Yeah. Because it's too early to buy drink. They have a law that says you can't. That's not theocracy. Okay? That's just good laws that say there's a day. And what's unique is they got that from the Bible, that you have a day where you just shut down. But our liberated society says, do anything you want as long as you want. We got to finish. I apologize. I like to digress on history because there's so much to learn from it. Babel Sea was the source of all the world's religions against God, which was maintained for a while, first by Shem through Eber down to Abraham. But Babel, all the other religions come from Babel. Out of that land went forth Asher, another empire builder, and he built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Calneh, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calneh. Number 5. Now, I want to show you, you need 7 empires written down here. This is going to be on your test. First one, Babel. Under Nimrod. Number 2, Egypt. Under Pharaoh. Number 3, Assyria. Under Sennacherib. Babylon again. Under Nebuchadnezzar.
Nebuchadrezzar before Nebuchadnezzar.
No, they're actually the same, just different pronunciation. Number Persia under Darius. Greece under Alexander the Great. And then Rome. But what's funny is, third time's lucky, you find Babylon again because it's Babylon mystery. The empire will be back in power at the coming of the Antichrist. So, let's move on. Number 3, Mizraim, which are the Egyptians. We got Ludum, Anamim, Lehabim, Naphtahim, Pathrushim, Caslehim, that was Philistim, was Philista, and Kaphtorim. And Canaan begat, and he's got all these different. You've got Sidon, those were the Phoenicians of Tyre and Sidon. Heth, the Hittites. The Jebusite, remember Jebusite. Jebusite, you're going to see sometimes the term Jebus, Jebusite. That's where you get the term Jerusalem. That Jeru is Jebu. It's just the way they pronounce things, okay? So the Jebusites were the founders of Jerusalem originally before Israel took over. The Amorite, dwelling in Heshbon, there in Israel. The Girgashite, the Hivite, the Arkite, the Sinite, the Arvidite, the Zemarite, the Hamathites, the Flashlights, and the Termites.
Is that where they get Hamorite in from them? Hamathites?
If you want. Border of the Canaanites for Sidon, as I come as to Gerar, to Gaza, as I go to Sodom and Gomorrah. All of these things are listed by Moses here to give you. These guys didn't have maps. They had minds. And they were to visualize the locations of all these nations. It's an amazing thing. We have to have iPads and pictures. But when you said the Hivites, everybody knew exactly. Yeah, their empire used to be about 300 miles that way. They knew it. They kept all the information in their head. Now we come to the sons of Shem. Let's see. Let's get a Shemite to read this. Verse 21 to 32, Ediberto.
Unto Shem also, the father of all the children of Eber, the brother of Jacob, the elder, even to him were children born. The children of Shem, Adam, Nashor, and Arpasad, and Lud, and Aram. And the children of Aram, Uz, and Hul, and Gether, and Mash, and Arpasad, begat Salah, and Salah begat Eber. And unto Eber were born 2 sons. The name of the one was Peleg, for in his days was the earth divided, and his brother's name was Joktan. And Joktan begat Almodad, and Shelep, and Harasmaveth, and Zera, and Hadoram, and Osam, and Dikla, and Obal, and Abimel, and Sheba, and Opra, and Habila, and Hobab. All these were the sons of Joktan. And their dwelling was from Mesha, as thou goest unto Sephar, a mount of the east. These are the sons of Shem, after their families, after their tongues, in their lands, after their nations. These are the families of the sons of Noah, after their generations, in their nations. And by this were the nations divided in the earth after the flood.
All right, so this is how all the nations split up. They started off as single people with their wives and children and became great nations. Now let's quickly run through this thing. The sons of Shem, they move into southern Asia and spread out through all of Asia. The father of all the children of Edom, the brother of Japheth the elder, even to him were lots of children born. Here are the children of Shem. He's got 5 sons, Elam, and that's Persia and the Elamites here. You got Asher, which are the Assyrians, Arphaxad, that's Carmenea, Carmenea. Salah and Eber. Now, I want you to see a name here. Very important. All right? How many of you see this word Eber? Okay? You might see it. If you know the answer, don't. Just explore for a second. Eber is... He's an unusual fellow. Eber is the founder of the Hebrew-speaking peoples. Go to Genesis 14, verse 13. This is 14:13. And go ahead and read that as well, Edoberto.
And there came one that had escaped and told Abram the Hebrew, for he dwelt in the plain of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Pisco and brother of Aner. And these were confederate with Abram.
Okay, now this is how it's going to work, okay? Let's do our list here. We're going to start off, we've got Shem. Shem has a son, and his son is Arphaxad. Let's go back up here. We got Noah. Okay, we have the flood. Arphaxad had, what's his name, Selah? Yes, Salah. And after Salah comes Eber, correct?
Yes.
All right. Along in here, everybody speaks one language. Everybody speaks one language. I mean, there's three boys, three brothers. They're all speaking the same language, aren't they? Shem, Ham, and Japheth all speak the same language. Arphaxad still speaking the same language. Salah still speaking the same language. At the time of Eber is when Babel takes place, the Tower of Babel, which you'll read about in chapter 11, and the languages are confounded, and whatever language Eber was speaking, we come to Abram, and Abram is still speaking the language of his great-great-grandfather, Eber, and that language, if we can play it out, let's look at the word Eber. I'm not a Hebrew scholar at all, but let's Hebrew. Or what we've now write it as is Hebrew. If you speak the language of Eber, it was Hebrew. That is where the language came from. Abram was the Hebrew, meaning he was of the language. Somebody might look at somebody, and everybody basically looked the same. It's like looking in a sea of Filipinos. They all look the same, right? That was a joke. But everybody looked the same, but they said things differently. Here's somebody, and he's speaking something that sounds like German. Here's somebody else, and they're speaking something that sounds... Abram was the Eberu. Okay, yes, sir?
Oh, I thought from Noah, Adam, they spoke Hebrew or something.
Yes. Whatever, this is the thing. That the whole world has their language. We don't have time this semester to get into chapter 11 and talk about languages. It is a huge subject, and you'd have to take probably the whole hour just talking about languages. Everybody at the Tower of Babel walked away speaking a different language, correct? Mm-hmm. Their languages were confounded. They were made confusing on purpose, okay? They were divided. And whatever language Eber was speaking, okay, that's what his son spoke. And his son's son, and so on. They kept the language of their family being passed on because parents teach their children their language. Abraham speaks the language going back through Eber, and he's known as the Hebrew speaker. It just is funny that Eber and Hebrew are the same root word. The theory is, and I'm not sure that I can prove it, but it is probable, that Eber is speaking the language of everybody back to Noah. God preserved that language through Eber. God didn't give Eber a new language like he gave other people. He changed other people's languages, but he kept Eber's language. That's the theory, and I like that theory because it makes sense to me.
The thought that came to my mind is that Hebrew then is the original language.
There you go.
But what you mean so before you said that, I was just going to read that. Are you saying that Hebrew is the original language?
Yes.
It makes sense to me.
Because God seems to like this crazy, squiggly language called Hebrew. Because when you go back to ancient Hebrew, it's crazy, simplistic pictograms. But God seems to like it. And so when we get to heaven, we'll speak Hebrew.
Well,
Texan
form of Hebrew?
Texan is a form of... We all say y'all and I reckon. So it's got to be right. So.
Didn't you say that Hebrew was a mix of... Or every language is a mix of former Hebrew.
Yeah, this was some guy said, an expert, he said that if you kind of study the etymology and stuff, that all the other languages can be traced as like the syntax of Hebrew and stuff. They just they just mix it up, and the format or whatever is just a jumbled up version of Hebrew, whereas Hebrew is
the pure,
the standard.
There is some depth to Hebrew that is not in any other language. There are things that I've read that just blow my mind. I can't even begin to fathom. I will say this: all languages have fundamental similarities. We all have verbs, we all have subjects and things like that. So it's hard to prove, but it is interesting. Okay, like I say, all languages seem to have a characteristic of 12. Every single language, when they count numbers, they have a type of numerology that goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And then after that, it goes crazy. 13, 14. You may not think that that means anything, but it is a unique thing that every language has a worship of the first 12 numbers. They seem to make these numbers very important. 13, 14, 15 are a whole different way of saying numbers. 21, 22. You hit 31, 32. But when you hit 11, it doesn't go 11, 12, or whatever.
Yeah.
Something happens, and at 13, things change. So the point is, Hebrew seems to have an influence throughout all languages. I can't take it any further than that. Let's rush on. So, in Peleg's day, does anybody notice that word Peleg? Look in his son, verse 25. After Eber, who's the son after Eber? Peleg, all right? So Peleg, it says, in Peleg's day, was the earth what?
Divided.
Okay. When was the earth really divided? Probably. Now, I'm not going to absolutely say, although I believe with all my heart. I believe the earth was divided here, earth as in dirt. But the earth was divided, language-wise, here.
It says okay. Divided later anyway, or whatever.
Yes, in verse 32.
The nations divided in the earth
after the flood. So I'm fully convinced, okay, that here, during Peleg's time, is when you have all the languages. And Peleg runs around with Eber's language, and that's Hebrew. Okay, that's why we stick with that theory, okay, that Eber has the founding words in Hebrew. So for his day was the earth divided. His mother's name was Joktan, Southeast Asia. You got all those names. Don't have to worry about them, but you got two more names there. D. Lud, settled Lydia in Asia Minor. And Amram, that's in Lydia is in Turkey. And Amram, the ancestor of the Syrians. Amreb is a parent of Uz, that's the land of Job. Hul, northwest Syria. Gether, southeast of Syria. And Mash, which is Mesopotamia. Now, these are the sons of Shem after their families, of their tongues and their lands, their nations. Notice that. Their tongues. These are the families of the sons of Noah after their generations, their nations, by the nations divided after the flood. Why does he mention the word tongues? Why does he say that? I thought tongues weren't actually divided until chapter 11. I've had a charismatic tell me that and says, well, there were tongues before they were divided. Mm-hmm. How do you answer that, Barry? Some people are just plain stupid.
It obviously is talking about events that have gone past chapter 11.
Yes, because chapter 11 actually goes back to deal with Eber, Peleg, and the dividing. It's just like Moses saying, I'll get to that, I'll come back to that, describe how the tongues were divided. So he's looking at nations after. He's not just dealing with people. They all had one tongue until the division. So you got a map there. You're going to want to be able to figure out where some of these places are and where the direction of the different people groups are. Are there any questions? Because we're going to take a quick break, and I'm going to come back. I'm going to review Genesis and get you prepared for the final in the next 30 minutes. So take a quick break.